Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director with the League of Education Voters. 2017 is shaping up to be a big year for special education. You may have heard in March about Andrew versus Douglas County School District, a case where the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a unanimous decision that under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, schools must provide students an education that is reasonably calculated to enable a child to make progress appropriate in light of the child's circumstances. Meanwhile, here in our state, the American Civil Liberties Union of Washington has filed a lawsuit against the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction on behalf of a public school student, actually public school students, the organization says were wrongfully disciplined because of their disabilities. Across the state, students who receive special education services are suspended or expelled about 2 times more frequently than their classmates. The lawsuit alleges that the state superintendent's office failed to address that problem and provide schools and teachers with needed support. Here to tell us more about both lawsuits is David Honeyeager, Director of Legal Services at Team Child, a legal aid program that provides direct legal services to youth to help them access the resources they need to be successful in the community. David was a staff attorney with Team Child for more than 10 years. Prior to working at Team Child, David was a staff attorney at Snohomish County Legal Services, practicing family and housing law. Info on Team Child at teamchild.org. David, tell me more about Team Child and what you do in the special education arena.
Thanks, Eric. Well, Team Child is a legal aid program. We work with youth, primarily youth 12 to 18, although older youth as well, and we help them access civil legal resources in the community. So we do a lot of work, and we're probably best known for our work around education, and there are a lot of different aspects of that. Special education is definitely a big part of that, as is discipline, and also enrollment and some other issues around education. But we also work with clients to help them access public benefits like mental health services, other types of health care, and other types of public benefits. And we also work with youth to help them access safe and stable housing when they're in a situation that's not safe and stable. There are actually many other civil legal issues that we work on as well. We prioritize working with youth who are at risk of or are already involved with the juvenile justice system. Team Child was founded with the idea of trying to help these youth who kept cycling into the juvenile justice system and really for reasons related to their inability to access resources in the community. So whether it was school or maybe an issue at home or an issue with mental health, the goal of Team Child was to help these youth and work directly with them to get them what they needed so that they would stop cycling through that system. Let's see, so how do we do special education or what's our involvement there?
Yeah, how would you describe the landscape in Washington?
You know, I think primarily our work around special education involves our direct casework. We work directly with youth clients. With special education, when a youth is under 18, their parent or guardian is actually the person who holds the legal rights, so we also work with them. But our service model is a stated interest model, so we're working directly with the youth, and we want to be sure that the thing that we're working on is the thing that they actually want help with. So we're working in concert with the youth and the parent. In terms of our special education advocacy, along with the direct casework, we do some policy work. We may consult with folks. We're trying to do more around training in the community, trying to engage more with the community about what they're seeing and what they want, how special education services are affecting them. That's an area that we're working on, but that's kind of the broadly how we're involved with special education. So the landscape,
yeah.
That's a tough question because there's not one landscape. Mm-hmm. I think it really depends on a lot of different factors beyond the youth's control and the family's control. It might be where folks live. Economics definitely plays a role in access to resources. I think probably the students who are in King County may have a lot of a different situation because there are more community resources and options here. And that might look like, you know, mentoring programs, might look like extracurricular activities that can supplement, but also with youth who need more services. You know, a lot of the experts and folks that schools might be or should be consulting with to help them craft a program for the student, a lot of those folks are on the west side. So for families and schools that aren't on the west side, it can be a lot harder to access those things. That's kind of general. I think also youth who come from families with economic resources may have a lot more options and often do have a lot more options. So our clients are primarily folks who come from low-income backgrounds. So they don't have access to those resources. So if the school's not getting those resources to them and doing an appropriate plan, a lot of times those folks don't have a lot of recourse. or at least help in trying to change that situation. So it can really vary based on kind of where the youth is coming from and factors beyond their control.
How would you describe the Supreme Court's Andrew case and also the lawsuit happening here in Washington against the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction? What are the both of those about, would you say?
Well, they're both about special education services. I think really broadly about raising the level of service provided and the standards for those services provided to students with special education. The Andrew F. case, I'll try to encapsulate that first. That is about the standard, like at the end of the day, what really are schools required to do to help students with special education needs. Prior to Andrew, I don't know if this gets too wonky, you can let me know. Prior to Andrew, the standard was based on this case called Rowley, I think from the 80s, maybe early 90s. And that standard was widely understood as the school has to provide services so that there's the opportunity for the student to make some progress. It could even be de minimis progress. So if a student has a special education plan, they should have goals in that plan around the reasons why they actually have the plan to begin with. So if they have a disability in the area of math or reading, they should have a goal for math and reading, and probably multiple goals. And those goals should lay out how much progress that student is expected to make each year. The special education delivery model is on it's called an IEP, Individualized Education Program. They happen annually at the very least, reviewed annually, but that goal should indicate how much progress they're going to make each year. So de minimis progress, I mean, in theory could be, you know, maybe the student is at a second grade reading level. Maybe they're actually an eighth grade student, but they're at second grade reading level. De minimis progress, maybe that looks like moving from a 2.0 in your grade equivalency for reading to a 2.3 or 2.5. It could even be lower than that, but that's maybe de minimis. And I should say that even when that was the standard or understood to be the standard, there were a lot of students who are not making any progress year to year. If you look at their IEPs, you know, their sixth grade IEP, seventh, eighth, their goals are the exact same, which is a strong indicator that they weren't making any progress during that time, which obviously that's a big problem. That kind of goes against the whole point. The Andrew case challenged the common understanding of the Rowley standard. And what the court came down with was that de minimis is definitely wrong. So that's very good. They're clear that it was wrong. There's not one size fits all for special education. There shouldn't be. The first, you know, letter of the acronym is individualized, right? So the court said that it should be an individualized inquiry into the student's capacity in terms of what's reasonable to expect for them to move forward. Ideally, the student is able to make a year's worth of progress in a year. That's what the expectation should be. So the team needs to look closely at what the student's disabilities are, what their capabilities are, and if it's possible and reasonable to think that they should be making a year's worth of progress, then that's what the goal should be. Also, more importantly, what the result should be. But if that's not the case, the court standard is looser. It should be tailored to that student's capabilities and circumstances. So it depends, you know, which is very loose, and sometimes that's not very helpful and maybe frustrating, but it is individualized. But nonetheless, I think that's a much better standard than the de minimis standard, at least most folks' conception. Obviously, the attorneys who brought the Andrew F. case didn't feel that was the standard, and they were right, so which is great. I think it's still too early to say what the impact of that is going to be. Uh-huh. I think it's going to be positive, but it's going to be, I think, largely on a case-by-case basis. You know, and like I referenced a little bit earlier, even when folks were thinking about the old standard, there were still a lot of youth, you know, a lot of clients that Team Child had, a lot of cases that we had, but, you know, we're only in four counties in Washington. There are a lot of clients and students who are not making any progress. The school districts were failing the previous standard. So it's going to be really important for folks in school districts and OSPI, hopefully, to try to address and acknowledge the new standard and make sure that the youth are making appropriate progress, progress that's appropriate for them. Mm-hmm. All right, second part of your question. That was a good question. So the second part is the ACLU case. As you said in your intro, real broadly, it's about how students with disabilities are disciplined. Mm-hmm. I think to really get into that, probably we need a two-hour, you know, Team Child training about special education and discipline. That's one of our community trainings and could be several hours, but I'll try to make maybe 2 or 3 minutes. Okay. Like I said earlier, when a student has a special education plan, they have it for the reasons they are eligible, and there should be goals and services related to that. So for reading, there might be accommodations around maybe a note taker, maybe materials presented in a different format, And there should also be goals and services to help the youth improve their reading and make progress and essentially learn how to read. The same is true for behavior. It really shouldn't be any different. If a student has behavioral disabilities that has made it hard for them to be in the classroom environment, a general education classroom environment, what the school district should be doing in their IEP is analyzing that behavior, figure out kind of what's behind it, get as much information as they can about the disability, and come up with both services and accommodations and goals around the behavior. That could look like a behavior plan where if a student has a disability that makes it hard for them to react to conflict or negative direction in a productive way, it might escalate things. Mm-hmm. It's really trying to look at, well, why are they escalating? And what does the student need to do and try to learn to not escalate in that way so that they can maintain appropriate behavior? But it's also, and this is an important point, showing the teachers and the folks who are working with the school district with that student how to help that student learn that behavior. Year by year, you should see progress on those goals too. Same type of progress, especially with the new standard. Yeah. So when that's not happening, and again, we see a lot of clients where they have the same behavior goals year to year, and there's very little or no progress. Those students are often placed in classrooms called EBD classrooms. Mm-hmm. And EBD is a category of eligibility, emotionally behaviorally disabled. The students often get stuck in those types of classrooms. And the focus of those classrooms is usually behavior. Mm-hmm. And often it's just behavior.
And no academics then?
Not much academics. So what you see, it's kind of a compounding problem. So year to year, you'll see no progress on the behavior. And so that means that the student will be stuck in that classroom. But you also won't see any progress on the academics too. And it's compounding also in the sense that I think a lot of students, I've had several clients in this situation, they get more and more frustrated and more aware that they're not making gains in reading or math. And for some students, they might become really embarrassed about that. Mm-hmm. They're very aware of it. They start to believe that they're not smart, they can't make progress. Yeah. And so they may resort to acting out so that they avoid the embarrassment of being exposed in the classroom when they have difficulty reading a passage out loud or doing a math problem up at the board. And so they act out to avoid that embarrassment. So in some ways, it's a productive behavioral response for them because it gets them out of a bad situation. Mm-hmm. But it's not productive in terms of them being able to maintain behavior in the classroom that allows them to actually get back into the more academic-focused classrooms. There's another concept that's important. It's a least restrictive environment concept. There's a whole bunch of different types of environments at schools. Your kind of typical environment might just be kind of a normal classroom, and that's what's called the general education environment. Mm-hmm. Students with special education, they may be placed in more restrictive environments, like the EBD room, but what the law says is that the schools should really be doing everything they can to help the students stay in the general education population and be with their regular education peers. It's only when they've tried things and nothing else is working that they should be moved into a more restrictive environment. What we find a lot is that our clients are placed in the more restrictive environment and they're not making progress in getting out. There's no concrete plans or steps for the client to understand like what they need to do to move back into the more mainstream environment. Mm-hmm. And they're also not new tools to bear. When we see the same IEP goals year to year on the behavior, what we also usually see is the same behavior plan. I mean, at a certain point, if the same behaviors are happening, the response is the same, you're getting the same results, the team should be looking at that and thinking, we need to try something different because this isn't reaching the student. We're not helping him or her learn different behavior. Mm-hmm. We're not having success. So what do we need to do differently? And maybe that means bringing out a district-level expert. Some districts have behavioral consultants. I've had some really good experiences with some of them. So that might be an option that should be considered. Or it might be bringing in someone else, you know, maybe an autism expert from the community, maybe an expert in some other of the disability categories that often lead our clients to the EBD rooms. But those are all options that should be happening. So that's like very briefly what happens with students with disabilities in special education. The ACLU lawsuit is about things being stuck, students being stuck. The four clients, the named plaintiffs, definitely seem stuck. Mm-hmm. It's about the school districts not doing more to help those students access the more mainstream curriculum and learn behaviors. But really, the lawsuit is about OSPI's failure to monitor and provide guidance and supervise what the districts are doing around special education. They claimed 3 or 4 different specific legal violations in that. They also talk a lot about the data that's now been out, I think, 4 or 5 years about the disproportionality in discipline. I'm probably not going to get the numbers quite right, but I think special education students represent about maybe 13-14% of the student population in Washington, but they are disciplined in a rate around twice that, maybe a little bit more than twice that. So that's a problem. That's a flag that OSPI should be looking at really closely. This data is not new at this point. And districts should be looking at closely to figure out what's going on. The other piece of their lawsuit, which I think is really important, is that it's not just the discipline that gets noted in the records. And that could look like a suspension, a detention, a suspension just for the day, or a short-term suspension, which is up to 10 school days, or a long-term, which is beyond 10 school days. ACLU's lawsuit is also about the more informal things that happen, where the teacher may just call the family and say, she's having a really bad day, just come get her. Or they may say, you need to go to the quiet room or the detention room or sit outside the classroom for the next period. Those things often aren't tracked in the same way, so it's hard to know, really. And so probably that figure, that 28 to 29% figure, is probably lower than the reality of what's happening.
So it sounds like OSPI is the target of the lawsuit because they're the stopgap. I mean, obviously the districts are sort of the middleman, as it were. It's the schools is where the issues are happening. The districts either are aware of it and aren't doing anything or aren't aware of it. And then it's OSPI's job to be the ones to make sure that the kids are getting the supports that they need. I know that OSPI has a new director for special education. What really could OSPI do from a statewide level to really make change here?
I think they could probably do a lot. As you said, they are the end of the road. Like, it's their responsibility in the end to make sure the school districts that they're charged with supervising and monitoring are doing what they need to be doing. OSPI has a lot of options. They can be really a guide and a model and a leader in how school districts should be doing this. And I should know that there are districts and schools who are doing a good job around discipline broadly and around special education discipline. And, you know, when I say that, really what I mean is more working with students with special education services who have behavioral disabilities and working with those students so that what they're actually doing is not disciplining them. But OSPI could be doing a lot around that. They do have responsibilities around monitoring and guidance, especially the aspect of the ACLU's lawsuit that gets at the discriminatory element of this. A lot of times these students are being disciplined because of their disability. There's a direct link between the reason they get in trouble in the classroom, whether it's a disruption or something else. There's a direct link between that and their disability. And so by disciplining them for their disability, that's discrimination. It seems pretty clearly against probably several laws in Washington. And OSPI has monitoring and guidance over that and responsibilities over that. So as a role model, as providing direction and leadership, I think there's a lot that they can do.
How much of this is a mindset issue? Because there's a number of adults who don't believe that every child can learn. If we could change that mindset so that adults in buildings really do believe that every child could learn, what would that look like? What impact might that have on resources for special education?
That would look great. And it is really true. You know, I think there are probably a lot of different factors at play when a school or staff feel like this student can't learn. Those school and staff, like, they work with those students every day. They know a lot more about students and how to work with students than the folks who don't work in schools. But even at that level, there are times when folks just seem to believe that the student can't learn, or the student's choosing not to learn, is making volitional choices to disrupt the classroom. But I think there's been a lot of advances, and some of them aren't so recent, but there's been a lot of advances around, you know, understanding how adolescents develop, understanding how the brain works, and also understand the impact of trauma. And once there's that understanding, there are ways to help youth in those situations. The Lincoln High School Alternative School in Walla Walla did incredible work when they focused more on the impact of trauma. So all that is to say that there's a lot of possibility for really great results, definitely better results than we have right now. And I think that once people understand that, that would give people some hope and some optimism, I think more energy. The other issue, though, comes down to resources. Yeah. The ACLU lawsuit talks about positive behavioral, PBIS. Mm-hmm. That's a great program, and that program's been around for a while, but it does take resources to implement that and have fidelity to it and to keep it going year to year. So it's also a resource question. If the mindset of folks can change, they can see that there's possibilities and that there are more resources. I think the landscape around special ed overall could really change. We could really see these youth making progress. And I think actually maybe the most important thing is that those youth would believe that they can make progress. And they might be much more invested and feel like, wow, someone's actually helping me and getting to me and like kind of understanding what I need. And I'm starting to understand that better too. That can make a big change. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of our clients start to internalize, and actually clients in special education and outside, they start to internalize messages they're getting from the school that maybe I don't belong here. This isn't going to work for me. I should stop trying. I'm a problem. They internalize those messages, and it's really hard to push past that and to get excited about school again, excited about your teachers and your school environment, excited about learning. So I think those changes for youth can make a big deal too.
I think what a lot of people don't realize is that changes to special education impacts general education. If we make the landscape better for kids who are in special ed, the individualization of learning, that actually can apply to every student as well. So what can we do? What can we do as parents, as advocates, as community members to start making things better?
Well, we can pay attention. We can pay attention to the ACLU lawsuit. We can pay attention to what OSPI and the districts are doing. I think some schools are starting to pay more attention to the idea of school climate and the importance of that. And I think folks getting engaged around that. I think, you know, kind of the, this gets more into the discipline aspect, but the zero tolerance approach in that philosophy might be appealing on some level, like get the students out who are causing trouble. But I think the studies have shown that in districts or schools where it's very punitive and heavy-handed, once that first wave of students who are causing all the problems, once they're out, things aren't better. There's not less disruption. There's the same amount of disruption. Students start to believe that they see other students not being treated fairly, so why would they be treated fairly? That reduces buy-in and reduces just kind of the spirit of working together and having a good community with schools. So I think that schools who have worked on that have seen better results across the board, as your question indicates, not just special education, but also regular education. And so I think if folks get more concerned about that, ask questions about that, I think that school administrators are going to take notice of that and respond, and districts will too, and hopefully bring more resources to bear as well. Some of that stuff is definitely not easy. Changing school climate, it takes a lot of work and resources. I should say that we definitely experience and encounter and work with and school administrators and programs that are doing a good job around discipline and special education. And there are definitely some bright lights out there in the counties we work in, and I'm sure in other counties too, but they're kind of isolated at times, it feels like. So like helping to support those folks who are doing a great job and those teachers who are doing a great job, I think can make a big difference. And again, a little bit that comes back to resources, but also comes back to attitude.
David Honeyager is the Director of Legal Services at Team Child. David, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Eric. Good to talk to you.